Hey everyone, welcome to the latest episode of Turkish.
We back.
It's your girl, Abadesi.
It's your boy. That's not, sound like Jay-Z. It's your boy, Michael Behaim.
That would be sick though. Imagine if you were listening to Turkish one day and it was just like on. Jay-Z and Beyonce, and special guest.
Jay-Z have got a lot of explaining to do actually. A lot of people are hating on him now.
But what?
We talked about it last episode. It got even worse. But anyways, I digress.
New episode, new topics. Michael, what's happening this week?
So I want to start with a bit of depressing news. Situation in South Africa, like, it's kind of gone into a bit of a mad thing over there. So essentially, there's been a few incidents over the years and it's kind of flared up again where quote-unquote foreign nationals, i.e. mainly African migrants into South Africa, have been attacked. Their businesses have been looted in like a whole wave of like xenophobic attacks. They're calling it Afrophobia because essentially, you know, they're not necessarily attacking the white elite who pretty much own the majority of the wealth in the country. It's the visible African migrants that are, you know, got the shop, you know, the shopkeeper, whatever, the petrol store owner, I don't know. And it's very depressing. I mean,
petrol store.
I don't know. I couldn't think of anything. Yeah, I don't know. Whatever. But,
like, so I was just imagining like a petrol store.
What was the right word to use?
Petrol station.
Petrol station owner. Okay, go. So, have you been to South Africa before, Abba?
I was in South Africa earlier this year.
Wow.
So I was there in March. I was in Johannesburg. The last time I had been before that was in 1996.
Wow.
So quite a big difference. Is very interesting. So I did a tour of Ponte Tower, which is in many ways the history of this building is almost like a metaphor for like South African society.
Right.
So it was created initially in a very affluent and wealthy part of Johannesburg during the apartheid government where racial segregation took place.
Mm-hmm.
And what I learned when I went on this tour and learned about the history of this building was that that particular building, like the people that lived there, were actually kind of a bit more progressive in terms of their thinking. And a lot of them ended up fraternizing with blacks, even ending up having relationships, you know, with each other. So kind of like Trevor Noah's parents' generation, Now, the apartheid government was so angry at this idea of them rebelling that they then started like cutting off electricity and water to that building to force affluent people out. And the knock-on effect of that was that what was previously an extremely affluent white area all around Ponte now became actually like quite derelict and deprived area. And what I didn't know was that after the time that apartheid ended, 1996?
Yeah, I think around that, yeah. Around the time he actually went. I think Mandela became president in 96.
Okay, cool.
Apartheid was ended like early 90s, like 93, 94, 95.
So after that, there was an influx of migration of other Africans into South Africa because South Africa, you know, under the apartheid government, relative to other African economies, extremely developed, etc. Right. So now this crazy thing happens where South Africans who had gained control of apartments in Ponte were now renting them out to Africans who had newly arrived. And it would not be uncommon for you, let's say you've just come from Zimbabwe, Zambia, wherever, you know, Michael with his wife and his kids to show up to the apartment where you've been forced to pay 3 months cash in advance because you're an immigrant and no one trusts you.
Yeah.
To now enter the 2-bed apartment, which was made for occupying 4 people max, and realize there are 3 or 4 other families
already in the building.
Already in the building.
Wow.
So this idea of Africans from outside South Africa being on a lower tier to South Africans already kind of started happening back then and existing back then. And what I learned when I was in South Africa in March through, you know, my friend lives there and she employs staff in her house. So her nanny is from Zimbabwe. And she was saying how when she gets into car sharing taxis, you know, just trying to get hitch a ride, she will avoid speaking.
Right.
Because once she speaks and they realize she can't speak any local dialects, the like hatred starts.
Unbelievable, but not surprising. I think I've never been to South Africa and I've always wanted to go. not so sure now anymore. But
I mean, it's really interesting. It's an interesting country, and like, it's that's
absolutely
why
I wanted to go. Like, I'm you know, I've always been a massive admirer from afar of like everything they've done there and the history of the country and, you know, the struggle that they had to fight. I mean, that was Africa's struggle. Everybody was behind the struggle against apartheid, which makes this even more so sad. I think the reason why I'm saying it's not surprising, though, is that, you know, from what I've read, essentially political apartheid ended, but economic apartheid didn't for the masses of black people in South Africa. They were not emancipated financially.
Gosh,
the wealth was still in the hands of the elite, the white elite, pretty much the white minority elite, sorry. And
it's still there.
I think the unemployment rate, I've got the stat in front of me, is 28%. And I'm like, I can imagine the youth unemployment rate probably is even like 70-80%.
And can we look at unemployment among racial lines?
Absolutely.
That's
the thing about this data
that's so warped, right?
But we can imagine. We don't even need to even know. Like, I know that 28%, probably the bulk of that is the black masses, or the coloureds, as well as the black masses. They call them coloureds, the kind of mixed race population in South Africa. That's their own designation.
You know what's so interesting? When I was in South Africa, I saw posters, because they had elections coming up. I mean, maybe they've already gone now. Like, truthfully, I don't follow South African politics closely enough. Mm. But someone's campaign pledge was, I will do reparations.
Got you.
So he was like, if Julius I get into power...
Julius Malema, I think the guy with the red hat. Yeah, he's quite famous. I know who he is, yeah.
Take back the land from the white families that still own it.
The party's called EFF or something like that.
Redistribute the wealth.
The Red Beret.
And it was really interesting to hear different South Africans' perspectives on this. Mm. Obviously, some of the older white South Africans I spoke to were like, this is preposterous, this is ridiculous. And, you know, some of the younger folks, when I was in Ponte City, for example, the people doing the tour were 20-something young Africans from neighboring countries who'd come to South Africa. One of the guys there, he was from Sierra Leone. Mm-hmm. He left his family 4 years ago to come study. He's sending money back. He hasn't seen his family since then.
Got you.
He can't afford to travel back.
Yeah.
And then people like him are just like, wow, you know, real power, influence, comfortable standard of life comes from having wealth here, and the disparity between who really has wealth and who doesn't is so big. In a lifetime, we couldn't get to that.
And I think that's the thing that most people don't really understand about poverty. It's not necessarily what your standard is, it's what's around you. And I think we've all seen those studies where they're like, who are the happiest people on earth? And every so often you'll see like some
Nigeria
country, you'll see some impoverished nation and people there are wildly happy. And you think, how is that possible? Because it's all about relative poverty. If I'm poor and people around me are just like bajillionaires, I'm obviously going to be frustrated. And that's what I'm seeing. I think it's happened here. Like, and they can't access the actual economic elite. They can't access the banker CEO. But what they can do is attack the quote unquote foreigner who is visible to them, who is accessible to them.
Mm-hmm.
It's even more worse though, because I think the anti-foreigner sentiment has been stoked up even by a lot of the political establishment as well. A lot of, like, I think the head of the police came out as a viral video, I think it's from a few years ago, where he's like, oh, you know, Johannesburg is 80% foreigner, we're going to have a foreign national as our president one day.
Mm.
And it's sad to see that kind of populism that we're used to seeing in like the quote-unquote West.
Yes.
Now migrating its way to the most economically developed country in Africa. And that kind of thought process, it's not a skin color. It can infect anybody. That's the problem. This is the problem.
I was going to check you there, though, because I don't think xenophobia comes from the West.
No. What I'm saying is that we attribute that kind of anti-immigrant sentiment to the developed Western countries, because those are the countries because of the developed, they tend to have the most amount of migration towards them. Right.
I also am going to challenge you there.
Go on.
In Nigeria, for example, we had this movement called Ghana Must Go.
Yeah.
Which is where Nigerian people literally expelled Ghanaians from the country. Till today, we still call those Chinese plastic carrier bags, those big plaid ones with a zip at the top.
Right.
We still call those Ghana Must Go, because when Ghanaians fled the country...
I'm not saying the reality is not the case. Like, I agree with you. In reality, that is the case. But what I'm saying is the perception is that, and the common dialogue is that, oh, this is a Western problem. And what I'm saying is that in any situation where there is the masses of people who are frustrated, we have to be careful, because xenophobia is always around the corner if people, unfortunately, are not given what they need and deserve, to be honest.
Xenophobia is a human problem.
It's a human problem, I know, and we have to acknowledge that. Mm. And I think we have to be careful as, you know, people of colour, as black and brown people, or people from the African continent, that we don't think that can't impact us, because it can. And this is what's happened. And actually, it's your folks that are getting the brunt of it. So a lot of Nigerians have been attacked. I don't know the exact numbers, but a lot have been killed. And now Burna Boy has come out and said he's not going to
South Africa.
Another prominent Nigerian artist has said, I'm not going anymore. And now there's been attacks of South African businesses in Nigeria, the MTN, which is quite a massive conglomerate in South Africa, based in South Africa. So it's like, but for a Pan-Africanist, this is a nightmare. Like, it's just crying to sleep at the moment, honestly.
And white South Africans, this is probably a very welcome distraction.
Completely.
From the animosity and negativity that has been directed at them, right? Because the truth is, they are majoritively the landowners, the business owners, the wealth owners in that country. It shows a complexity of identity in that country as well.
Completely.
You know what I mean? It's like, as a Black South African, again, I'm not a Black South African for the record, but just trying to empathize with that position. Who do I feel more connected to? Mm. A white South African, when I am structurally oppressed by the history of white supremacy in my country, or a Black African, where we share the bond of being Black people in a white supremacist state, but we don't share a national heritage.
Who do you side with? I don't even necessarily think it's a thing of who you side with, because there is plenty of animosity towards the white elite, but they just can't get to them. You know what I mean? You just can't get to them. But who do you see? And this is the thing about what you said it to me actually via text. This is what scarcity can do. The common thing that the protesters and looters are saying is they're taking our jobs. But these are business owners. They're not taking your jobs. Those jobs didn't exist. They created their own thing.
Yeah.
And they're probably hiring South Africans. So this kind of mindset of like, they're taking, it's a zero-sum game. It's only a small piece of the pie. When you're in scarcity financially, you start seeing the world that way. And it's like, I'm going to take what's mine. You are not going to come. And they even say things that you're taking our women. It's really, it's just like all around, it's a disaster.
Yeah.
And to me, it leads back to the fact that justice was not done. Genuine justice was not done after apartheid.
What's the antidote?
There isn't a quick fix now.
Of course.
There isn't a quick, and the most depressing thing is all of the goodwill that was built by Mandela, because a lot of people now have come out and said, listen, Nigeria housed Mandela during the struggle. Mandela went to Ethiopia and was trained. He went to several a lot of the apartheid leaders, when they were in exile, were trained by other African countries. They were supported. There was finances gathered. But that kind of Pan-African spirit and solidarity hasn't translated into the new generation. A, because the reality, financial reality, isn't there for them anymore. It's like, yo, I need to eat, fam. And B, we just took for granted that that solidarity would carry on. It doesn't necessarily mean that it will. And if we don't educate ourselves about, you know, how we've all relied on each other and what we all had to do to be, you know, free from our colonial shackles, this type of stuff is going to happen. We're going to turn on each other. And you see it like with diaspora wars on Twitter, like it's low key banter. But, you know, there's a kind of serious undertone where we're like, well, you know, F the Caribbeans, F the Nigerians, F this, F that. And it's like, come on, we're better than this.
It's interesting because when I was in South Africa, I went to the Apartheid Museum and they talked about Mandela, his life. I learned so much about him.
Madiba.
Yeah. And they also talked about his legacy and, you know, both sides of the table in terms of, did he do enough? Was there more that he could do? And a lot of people like criticize who he picked as his predecessor because they kind of feel like he had this whole lifetime he had a whole lifetime of like living through that struggle and being in the trenches and his own personal transformation, being in prison, blah, 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 to be able to like come out of that and sort of prioritize peace in the country. Whereas many people feel that he wasn't so careful in choosing who came next. And, you know, Thabo Mbeki had his own scandals, corruption, all that kind of stuff. The reason why I'm mentioning this is because this idea of like how we behave in like a time of scarcity, it kind of almost reminds me of things that I used to learn about at school, like reading like Hobbes, the philosopher, and his book Leviathan. This is like an old political philosophy text, but what he's basically saying in that is, in the absence of government, people behave as they would in a state of nature. And he came up with this idea of like people in their state of nature are basically being like feral savages. I'm in a time of scarcity. I'm fighting for the means to survive.
You become tribal, I think.
Yeah, so because you fight for the
you're not going to attack everybody, but you're going to be like, who's with me and who's not with
me? Exactly. And literally, so you're like, I need to survive. We're all competing for the resources to survive.
Yeah.
And that means sometimes we're going to clash. And the truth is, we are not in a time of scarcity. We are not in the state of nature. Of course, I don't just mean that from like the privileged perspective of someone who can afford to eat or afford to have a roof over our heads, but some of the people who are participating in these clashes, the threat that they perceive is greater than the actual threat in real life if they were to look at the data or to look at their lives. And I think it's really important to think of basically like the psychological realities that leads to violence and the psychological realities that leads to that. Because, you know, Brené Brown, who is a researcher, a sociology researcher, and has focused a lot of her stuff on shame and vulnerability. I was recently just re-listening to an interview she did with Oprah on Super Soul Sunday podcast. And she talked about the fact that in society where we don't permit people to share their feelings, to speak openly about what they fear, what they're afraid of, what they feel vulnerable about without judgment, then we create these situations where instead of people being able to be like, I am worried about whether or not I am going to be able to provide the life for my children that I know that they deserve because of all these things. When we don't create a space for people to have that dialogue, we just revert back, exactly like you're saying, to that tribal state where it's just like, right, fight or flight, let's go.
I definitely agree in a Western context that is true in the sense that scarcity, although real, isn't as it's very difficult actually to compare struggles, because I'm very afraid to say that scarcity isn't real in the sense that in the South African context, I feel like people are genuinely impoverished to a degree that we can't fathom. And I've seen some of the footage and I haven't been there in the flesh, so okay, this is obviously me from a bird's eye view. To say that, you know, that scarcity isn't real, it's like they're suffering, and as far as they're concerned, I don't think any amount of dialogue is going to fix what they need. They need economic relief of some kind. And I don't know what that's going to be. I don't know. And this is a very complicated situation. I don't know what's the... There isn't a quick fix. I think it's 20 years of bad policy. And I don't want to blame Mandela because I have never spent 30 years in jail. But I think once you get into power, compromises have to be made. And he made certain compromises in order to keep the peace. And we're now seeing the repercussions. Because he could have... the original... I think they called it the Freedom Charter that the ANC had. We're going to nationalize the banks. It's all going to be for the people, whatever, whatever. Very much, you know, quasi-socialist policies. But when he got into power, they were like... If you want hassle-free governance, the IMF, the World Bank, do not touch any of those institutions. Let the economic society as it is carry on.
Yeah.
And this is what's happened. We have impoverished people doing crazy things. So I saw a funny tweet. Well, it's not funny. It's kind of funny. I'll start again. So I saw an interesting tweet from Jason Fried of Basecamp, which is a famous software product. He typed in his company name into Google and there were 4 ads from competitors with the name Basecamp in it.
What?
Saying use our product instead of Basecamp. And then at the bottom of that was the organic search result for Basecamp. So he's like, listen, ridiculous. His tweet said, when Google puts 4 paid ads ahead of your organic result for your own brand name, you're forced to pay up if you want to be found. It's a shakedown. It's ransom. But at least we can have fun with it. So they put in their ad, Basecamp, we don't want to run this ad. In their own ad, that you have to put, right? Do you think that's an accurate assessment in the sense that it's a shakedown? Like if I typed in your name, Abadesi, could you imagine if there was 4 people saying, don't use Hustle Crew, use my company. And you're like, fam, this is my brand name. Like, how can you? And then the irony is that when you type in Google's products, that doesn't happen. You can't do an ad campaign on Google's products. You can't say on a Google Doc, If I type in Google Docs into Google, I'm not going to be allowed to create an ad saying, don't use Google Docs.
Yeah, exactly.
Can't do that. So if Google says you can't do it to our stuff, how are they allowed to do this to other people's brands?
That's messed up.
It's so messed up.
Go
on.
Let's talk a bit about Brave.
Oh, the browser.
Yeah.
Got you.
Because I feel like...
Explain what it is, though, to people that don't know what it is.
Well, it's just a browser that doesn't steal your data
for profit. It's based on the blockchain, though, isn't it, right?
Like Google does.
It's based on blockchain technology or some issue like that, right? I think it is. Right, yeah. And you can give, like, crypto... They have their own crypto token that you can think. Have I got that completely mixed up with something else?
Yeah, maybe, yeah. I mean, the only reason I wanted to say it was because I feel that, like, this conversation that Jason of Basecamp is starting is another reminder of the monopolization that Google has achieved in terms of internet searches, discovery, and let's face it, just surfing the web in general, right?
Completely.
I'm a Chrome user. I'm jumping in, typing in a search string, and Google is determining what I see as a result of that. In a previous episode, I talked a bit about divesting from big tech or just trying to think a bit more ethically.
Correct.
About the way I use technology. And a few people actually jumped into my DMs after that episode and made some suggestions for me.
What did they say?
Shout out Lucy, one of the folks who did. She talked about how you can swap from Gmail to Proton Mail.
I don't even know that.
Proton Mail got an account now.
Is it really good?
set up by CERN scientists.
Amazing.
Encrypted end to end. They don't even read our emails.
Fantastic.
So yeah, this whole, you know, base camp being taken hostage, whatever, it just doesn't taste good. You know what I mean?
It doesn't. I've been reading this book called Surveillance Capitalism. It's a very difficult book to read, but essentially it's looking at the business model of Facebook and Google and saying that they've created a whole new paradigm of capitalism instead of like managerial or industrial capitalism. This isn't surveillance capitalism, where the whole name of the game is to know you as much as possible and watch you at all times and then to create essentially a futures market on predicting your behavior.
Wow. And this is that's terrifying.
Yeah, it's terrifying, right? And like Google has every single search you've ever done stored. You have no access to it and you can never delete it, for example. That's one data point where I was like, you know what? I never thought about it. So I type into Google things willy-nilly, like just everything, where I'm just like, oh, I wonder what this means. Or like, I feel a bit ill. Or like, you know what I'm saying? And they have that stored against your user ID for eternity. And it's terrifying. And I think, you know, when you mentioned the whole divesting from big tech, I don't think I was giving you the credit that you deserve in the sense that I was kind of like, yeah, all right, cool, I get it. But I'm starting to seriously consider it as well now. I'm like, yeah, maybe we do got to like get away from Gmail and get away from Chrome and, you know, and start looking for alternatives and see how long we can last, because it's like, it's too much. On a separate point, so Facebook is doing Facebook dating now. they've released, we talked about it like a year ago, but now they've released it to the US.
Ooh.
You know, and it's people.
You're all right. Get married.
Get together, guys. And it's opt-in. You know, I'm sure it will have wide usage because people always want to date. You know what I'm saying? That's human nature. Like, and it's easy because you're not going to have to download a separate app. It's going to be within your Facebook app. They've already got all the data about you. They're going to know what groups you like, you know, what pages you like. And I'm sure it's going to produce like great matches. And in fact, the company Match, who owns Tinder, who owns OkCupid, who owns all these other like dating apps, they have lost like they did a massive drop in the stock market already, just off the announcement that Facebook is launching thing. But in the context of surveillance capitalism, now I'm looking through everything through that view, in the sense that Facebook doesn't ever have to really make money from this. This is now
another way
in the book to talk about, like, you know, the analogy, data is the new oil. I don't like it that much, but I get what they're saying. And this makes is like sense. A pipeline. This is just another pipeline into finding out as much consumer behavior data as possible.
Of course.
And they're funding, like I said, when I see things through that vantage point now, I don't even look at it from the point of view of, does Facebook even need to make money off this? Now this is just now more access to know about. Now your sexual peccadillo is like, what do you like? And now once I know that about you, you are now a far better target for advertisement.
Of course.
And I don't like it. It's so icky. Like,
I think surveillance companies should have a different tax to all other types of companies.
Completely. But then at the same time, I think
they're more messed up.
Yes. Yeah.
There's something that feels
icky.
Very. Just it's somehow icky. Evil as well.
It's
I don't
icky.
Know why. You know, like Homo Deus.
Yeah.
Yuval Noah Harari kind of talked a bit about this, and it's like, we're at this point where we don't even really understand the value of our own data.
Right.
Like I know that I have Facebook accounts and WhatsApp accounts and Instagram accounts, right? And I know that Facebook has a market capitalization of however many billions of dollars, and I know that on any given month they're making X revenue. But I don't know what percentage of that is a result of me using their products.
Got you.
And I then also don't know what my monetary value of using their products is, right? This is what he's talking about in Homo Deus in that book. And it's like, so how can we even start to try to have a fair relationship
not at all.
With these companies and society, or as an individual with these products, when there's all of these confusing data points and I don't know how to string them together?
And at the very least, I want to know, what are you predicting based off what you know about me? It's not necessarily what you know about me, because I know what they know. I've typed in this message, I've liked this page, but what voodoo doll version of me have you created based off that? Because that's what they do. They create, essentially, you know, they sell to advertisers the idea that Michael is this person, therefore he's most likely to do X behavior, or most likely to want this product, or most likely to, do you know what I mean? And it's like, I don't know all of those things. I don't know what you really know about me. story is like so wild, and but yet so symptomatic of a, like a macro problem. So Crazy Rich Asians, which I did see eventually, which is actually a really nice little cool movie, and it did a lot in terms of representation for friggin' Asian Americans awesome and movie. Asian people globally. What's that again? Say that, Abba.
I was like, friggin' awesome movie. If you're Asian, you appreciate the movie more. No, seriously, I watched it with my cousin.
That's real.
Watched it with my cousin, and so, you know, I'm half Filipino. I'm watching my Filipino cousin. We were like crying, laughing, like, oh my God. And then like the people next to us, these two white chicks, were just like, calm the fuck down.
But that's why representation matters though, doesn't it? Because like that film is never going to speak to me as well as it might speak to you guys. Like, you know what I'm saying? And that's the beauty of it kind of thing. So the story right now is that, so there was two writers.
Yes.
There was one white dude writer and there was one... Asian American. Her name was Adele Lim. She was a co-writer. They both co-wrote the film. The original budget of the film was like 20 million. It made like 300 million. So it made crazy money. It made VC returns. Yeah.
<Woo-hoo.
laughs> So anyway, now that the studio's like, okay, we're going to do a sequel. They offer the white co-writer up to $1 million. They offer her 100K. Yeah. Credit to the white dude writer. He was like, you know what? This is a disgrace. I will split half of everything I've got with you. As in, we'll meet in the middle. I'll give you half of my money, basically, so that we can think. And credit to also to Adele. She was just like, yo, it's not your job. It's the studio's fault, right? Like, you shouldn't have to do that. Pay me up. And the studio were like, oh, no, this policy. And in the end, she just upped and left.
Good.
Yeah. Now, the crazy thing is that, pardon the pun, crazy, she... is actually a more experienced writer than he is. Even though I don't even have to even go into this. Like, gender pay gap is real, and like there isn't even any justification necessary for me to even say this. But just in case you're listening to this and you're thinking, I don't get it. Like, she actually is more experienced than he is in the sense that she has been writing for successful television.
But she has a vagina, so you know that means she doesn't get it. She doesn't deserve it. She doesn't deserve it.
Talk on it. Break it down for us.
Well, you know, I'm just kind of thinking about the way the world works, and you know, she probably didn't ask for it, or there must be some reason why they're paying him so much more.
She should have leaned in.
You know, she co-wrote it. Maybe she just hit all the commas and the punctuation.
She came out and said essentially that she feels like a lot of like people of color who are writers are essentially used as quote unquote soy sauce to add like culturally relevant parts of the script. So like in a film like that, they might be like to the white guy, right? Okay, you come up with the plot and the story, and then you come in and
make sure
like,
it's not racist.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of like what I do sometimes in my work.
Spill that tea, man. They're just like,
on a very small version, right? If someone says to me, like, can you check this job ad?
That's what they're asking for.
That's literally what they're asking for. They're like, yo, I'm a straight white dude and I've written something. You're a black woman. Can you make sure that this isn't sexist or racist? Or, I mean, you know, but it's also like, can you make sure that it's written in a way that will attract those people? But it is basically saying, can you make sure it's not excluding them?
Yeah.
I think Hollywood, Silicon Valley, anything that's like an establishment, kind of like what we were talking about once upon a time in Hollywood, will take so long to break it down and dismantle it. And it's so friggin' ironic that a film that made waves across the world for being a game changer, I think it was like the first, since like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon over 10 years ago or something, the first all-Asian Hollywood blockbuster film, the fact that a film that did all of that still behind the scenes is battling with its own types of discrimination and bias. That to me is just ridiculous, but then like a perfect metaphor for how messed up progress on representation and inclusion is. You know what I mean?
Completely.
Like, we take one step forward and we take 50 jumps back.
Completely. And this is like, as much as representation matters, when the quote unquote machine, whether it's Silicon Valley or Hollywood, produces representation, what's going on behind the scenes? And this is an example of where, even though there's some progress visually, like on screen, we've got all these beautiful, amazing Asian American actors and actresses, but behind the scenes, you're screwing over the actual, the brain power behind all of it, and you're trying to give them 10x less? Insane. I'm so glad the story leaked, and I'm so glad the actual person in question, Adele, was like, F this, I'm out, and she made it into a big thing. Because I feel like, I'm sure there's a lot of pressure to keep things quiet and just to be like, don't rock the boat, this is going to be bad for your career, you're going to be known as someone who's difficult to work with, other studios are not going to want to rock with you, and it's such BS.
Nonsense.
So, you know what's interesting, actually?
What?
I think we underestimate how difficult it is to stay on top in tech. Because I was listening to a
podcast. On top of what? Top of the Pops?
Top of the Pops, yeah. No, on top in tech as a company, right? So I was listening to a podcast. They were talking about Uber. And it made me realize that to a certain extent, Uber has just become... It's kind of a commodity. Like, there's been a few other like ride-sharing apps that have launched in London. And like, I've just... created accounts and I've always just looked for the cheapest deal. Like, I don't, there's nothing about Uber per se that keeps me going apart from the fact that maybe if I go to a foreign country, I know that they're going to be there, right? So how do you prevent yourself from becoming a commodity? You get, you build features. But then the opposite problem is you build so much features that you get a tweet from Christine Teagan, I think that's how you say her surname, John Legend's wife and model. She came out and said, I will never understand Dropbox. Somebody invent an easier Dropbox. And it went viral. And then like the product manager, the chief product manager at Dropbox was like, I'm a big fan of your of you. Please let me help you like somehow. And everyone's like, guys, go to our house and help her. Like, and I think what that is, it's a funny story, right? But to me, it's symptomatic of the idea that you build all these, as a company, you start building all these features because you're trying to constantly differentiate yourself. And then eventually you bloat the product to the point, where it's unusable.
I mean, I also don't understand how to use Dropbox.
Yeah, I don't use it either. Have you tried to look into it and been like, I don't get it? Like, or is it?
Dude, we use it at Product Hunt where I work.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just, I know it's probably very intuitive to the people that work there and made it.
That is not a good sign for a product.
But I'm always just like, no, like, where is this? And it's like, I hover over something and then a checkbox appears. I'm like, okay, cool, there it is. But it's just, honestly, can I just say, like, I know that I'm very blinkered by my perspective of the world and my identity and stuff, but I can always smell products that have been designed and built mostly by men.
Oh, seriously? Wow.
Really,
what are the telltale signs?
They just... are not obvious. The way to use them is just not obvious.
It's not intuitive.
No.
It hasn't got that Apple, like, anybody could kind of use it.
I mean,
thing.
Apple's probably mostly guys as well, but I just feel that, like...
But in terms of the aesthetic,
you know,
meant to be,
a button looks like a button.
Got you.
A box looks like a box.
Yeah.
Labels... have words so right. that I know what they mean.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And I just feel like guys are just like, oh, let's just keep it minimal, keep it minimal, keep it minimal. I know where that is. I know where that is. I know where that is. And I was just like, yo, I don't want to like spend ages playing around with something to understand how to use it. I want it to be obvious.
Got you.
And I think if it takes more than literally 30 seconds to understand how to use something, it becomes a frustrating experience.
Yeah.
And then you're demotivated to learn how to use it more. And I think that happens a lot with Dropbox.
Yeah. I mean, I can imagine. Do you think I was right though in terms of that dichotomy in the sense that like as a company, you're worried about being, you know, becoming commodified. So you start building all these features.
Mm.
And then before you know it, the simple value of what you're trying to build eventually just kind of disappears. And people can't use the product anymore. Like,
I don't know. I think
you get caught between two different poles, right? Because I'm sure they were thinking to themselves, okay, everyone's got cloud storage. So we've got to make our product extra smart and extra, and extra snazzy and all these extra features and whatever, whatever. And then it's like, well, can somebody even know how to like onboard and know can the average person do this now?
Exactly. No, I think you're right. I think it's that. And I think it's also that our needs become more nuanced, right? Because Dropbox has been around for time. I think they did YC like 10 years ago or something crazy like that.
I remember when it first launched. I was like, whoa, this is
and
like magic.
When they first launched, it was the shit. It was just like, what? There was no WeTransfer.
Nothing.
I didn't even know. Was Google Drive there? I think
no,
it was.
There was nothing.
It was. Okay, so there was literally nothing.
I was
so
literally emailing myself my university essays.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Like, I didn't have a USB, so I'd be like, okay, let me just email myself the latest version.
Right.
Just so that I have the latest version.
Exactly.
So young people these days will be like, I don't even know what you're talking about.
Young people don't even have USB sticks on their key rings. Yeah. When we were at uni, we had USB sticks on our key rings.
One of my homies, his side business was selling like USB sticks in uni. He'd walk around and be like, yo, $1 USB stick. He's a hustler.
How times have changed. Right. So when Dropbox first came on the scene, it was like, what? Yeah. This is amazing. Yeah. Now, since then, it's not just about accessing files on the cloud or easily sharing files through the cloud, large size files with other people, etc. Now we have like other things that we want to do with regards to storing, sharing large files, accessing data. So it's kind of also like that, you know, the problem that you originally solved has changed or become more complex.
Got you, yeah.
Also, I think another thing that happens with a lot of SaaS companies, it's like it starts as an individual problem. So you're like basically building a B2C company.
Yeah.
And you're like, great, these are all the things we need. Then you go do Y Combinator or get any other type of outside funding. And they're like, gotta do B2B, gotta make a scalable B2B solution.
A $1 billion company.
And then you start trying to like build for enterprise, and what enterprise want and what consumers want are completely different things.
Yeah.
And so now you're like in this awkward middle ground of something that works for enterprise and works for, you know, a mum of three. And now what you've got is neither of them use it perfectly.
Yo, everyone, thank you for listening. That was this week's Techish. Use the hashtag Techish, like I always say, and engage. We are there, ready to kind of chat-ish with you. And
always love to hear from you.
We
if
love
you
lot.
Have not left us a review yet, why not? I'm offended.
You know what?
I
was so upset. Somebody left a 3-star review because their app didn't work. Their podcast app didn't work. And they were like, I couldn't download the episodes. So they gave us a 3-star review.
They gave Techish a 3-star
review. Yeah, bro.
Whoever you are, go back and correct that.
They
That's
ruined
not
our
fault.
Perfect score. I was like, wow. Oh my, now we got 4.9 stars. So, anyways, so
report
we need.
Report that.
Yeah, we'll report that. We
report
need
that.
5-star reviews. And sorry, people, if your podcast app doesn't work, I'm sorry, but please don't blame us.
Yeah, exactly. We got mouths to feed, specifically ours.
I'm hungry, all right? So, anyways, but thanks for everyone that has left a review. And if you could leave one, that'd be amazing. And yeah, if you want to support us with your hard earned dollars, those Patreon subscribers really do help. And go on patreon.com/techish. We've got about 9-10 subscribers. If we can get that up to 20, that'd be super awesome. And you get
exclusive
t-shirts content.
Coming soon.
T-shirts are dropping for real. They're going to come soon. Everyone's also asking me about the tees and the gift that we used to promote the episode. They're coming soon. And also, live show coming up in London.
Live
eventually,
show.
Sometime in November.
Live
Keep
show.
Your eyes peeled. It's going to sell hot and fast. Hot and fast. The tickets are going to sell hot and fast. Anyways.
Hot cross buns.
Anyways. So, but yeah, we'll catch you next week. I think that's all there is to say, really.
Bye.
Ciao. Bye.